What we're going to be doing this morning, last time I was here, if you can recall back a year ago, we started going through a section in the Gospel of Mark. We actually looked at the young rich man in Mark chapter 10. And what I thought we would do this morning, I was pondering on what we would do for our Bible class. And, you know, I just thought, well, you know, since I started in a section of Mark, I might as well keep going with another section of Mark. And I figure if I visit enough times that maybe we'll finish the whole gospel eventually. It may take us quite a bit of time, but maybe we'll be able to do that. But this section of Scripture is something that has really been a game changer for me in a lot of ways. It's a very powerful section of text. I'm going to spend a little bit of time getting us up to speed in the context of what Mark is going to be talking about here. But in Mark chapter 8, which is where we're going to be spending our time this morning, Jesus is beginning to get into the meat of what the Gospel of Mark is all about in a lot of ways. If you read the Gospel, you'll realize that there's this progression that goes on. Mark begins by introducing Jesus, and he begins like a lot of different Gospels do. There's obviously differences, but he continues on, and then when you reach chapter 4, he begins to teach the disciples things concerning the kingdom, and he begins teaching parables, and he begins to teach the disciples in a very progressive type of way, whether he's teaching publicly or just to his inner circle, to his 12, or to his initial disciples. He begins to teach very progressively, and there's a reason for that. You know, we can think of a lot of different reasons just, you know, based off of common sense. You know, when you begin to learn something new, you don't want to just throw it all at them at once, right? You want to give it to them in a way that they're going to be able to learn it, and they're going to be able to retain it. And Jesus is really doing this in a very systematic way. But we're going to be looking at Mark chapter 8, beginning in verse 27. But one of the themes that runs through the Gospel of Mark is things concerning the kingdom. Now, what is it that you need, just in a very basic sense, to have a kingdom? A king, okay. That's one thing. And subjects, right? So in order to have a king, or a kingdom, you have to have a king and you have to have subjects. Well, if Christ is the king, then what does that make us? That makes us the subjects, right? Well, what does that mean for us to be subjects of Christ? What does it mean for us to be disciples of Christ? You know, and we're going to get to that. You're absolutely right. We're going to get to that. But this is really what Jesus is trying to get his disciples to understand here in Mark chapter 8. And he's going to go through it in a way that will help us to better understand what it means for us to be disciples or followers of Christ, and what it means for us to be subjects in Christ's kingdom. And that's what we're going to be looking at. Would someone turn in their Bibles to Mark chapter 8, if you haven't already? Would someone read for us verse 27 and 28? All right, so as I mentioned before, Jesus is doing things in a very progressive way. And he's getting closer to Jerusalem. Jesus ultimately knows that he's going to have to die on the cross. And as he approaches that day, he realizes that he's got to teach his disciples what they need to know before they reach that period of time. So it says that he's going in that direction, and then he asks his disciples a question. What is the question that he asked, just to repeat it? Who do men say that I am? Who do people say that I am? Now notice that he doesn't begin by asking his disciples who they think he is. Why do you suppose that is? He says, who do people, who do the outsiders, who do they think that I am? Who do they say that I am? Yeah, that was their answer. But why is it that he's asking who the outsiders think that I am, as opposed to just asking them directly, who do you say that I am, first? No, you're absolutely right, and you said something very important there. You said that they should have more knowledge than the rest. You know, throughout the Gospel of Mark, again, you see that Jesus teaches his disciples a lot more closely than he teaches the outsiders. A lot of times you'll see him teaching the outsiders or all the crowds and the multitudes and things like that, and then you'll have Jesus teaching his disciples by themselves. So they should know more than the rest of the people. They should have a different answer. Who is this Jesus really? That's one of the main questions at the Gospel of Mark. If you can remember a year ago in Mark chapter 10, one of the main questions that the Gospel of Mark seeks to answer is, who is Jesus? This very question that Jesus begins asking. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And he says, who do those people, who do the crowds, who do the multitudes say that I am? And now they're recognizing Jesus as a prophet, right? What is their answer, as was mentioned before? You're John the Baptist, or they say that he's Elijah. He's someone special. They're just not quite sure who Jesus is really yet. They don't, you know, we see Jesus referred to a lot of things throughout his ministry in the New Testament. He's referred to as people like John the Baptist and Elijah, but he's also referred to as teacher, as rabbi, which means basically the same thing. You know, he's referred to as prophet, but is that all that Jesus is? Is that all, you know, is that all encompassing of what Jesus really is and who Jesus really is? No. He's the Son of God, and we're going to see Peter make that confession here in a second. But what the Gospel of Mark is seeking to answer is, who is Jesus really? Is he just another prophet? Is he just another man like Elijah? Or is he more than that? But he begins by asking, who do the people say that I am? If you continue on, reading in verse 29, it says, and he asked them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered him, you are the Christ. And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. So Peter makes this confession. He says, you are the Christ. And at a glance, it would appear that Peter knows what he's talking about. It appears that Jesus, or that Peter has come to a certain degree of understanding. Definitely has progressed from chapter 1, 2, and 3. You can see that very obviously, that Peter has come a long way. But in these verses that we're going to be looking at, it's going to be very clear that Peter didn't really understand about the confession that he made, that Jesus is the Christ. What does it mean for Jesus to be the Christ? Yeah, okay, so what was it that the Jews were anticipating the Messiah to be?
An earthly king.
An earthly king, right? Jesus, or the Messiah, was supposed to be the one that comes in and delivers the Jews out of the hands of the Romans and bring the Jews to power and do all these sort of things. But was that what the Messiah came to do? Was that the Messiah's purpose? Because again, what we're going to be looking at here in these next few verses is, first, we're going to have to understand what it means for Jesus to be the Christ. He is a king. Don't get me wrong on that. But he is not the kind of king that Peter was anticipating. And we're going to see that Peter, he said, you are the Christ. But he misunderstood what it means to be the Christ. He understands that he's more than just a prophet, that he's more than just, maybe even more than just a man. But does he understand what the role of the Christ is? Is and what role that the Christ is supposed to fulfill? So keep in mind what the Jewish mindset of the time is, of what they would have been expecting out of the Messiah, what kind of Messiah they were anticipating to come and be with them. Okay, so would someone read verse 31 for us? Okay, so there's really a fourfold prophecy, if you will, that the Son of Man must accomplish while he's here on earth. There's four things that he lists here. What's the first one? It says that he must suffer. Okay, so let's talk about that for a second. In what ways did Jesus suffer throughout his life? And again, you can probably think of a million right off the top of your head, but just throw some of those out. Okay, people tried to kill him, and actually, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a second. But in what ways did Jesus suffer? Think about things like when Jesus was going to his death. What happened to Jesus before he went to his death? He was rejected, but who was he denied by? His people, more specifically. Peter, right? He was rejected by Peter, his close companion. One of the people who he would have been closest to. Do you think that caused him suffering? You know, when we think about our close relationships with our friends and we think that they have our backs and that they're our friends, you know, to be denied by someone or to be rejected by someone who you're close to would definitely cause suffering. But it wasn't just emotional suffering or that kind of suffering that he endured. He was betrayed by Judas? No, you're absolutely right. That definitely would have caused him suffering. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. And that statement really emphasizes his humanity, right? What he was enduring while he was on the cross. The Son of Man must suffer. And again, you're going to see these things, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the rest of them. But we're going to see these things and how they would be contrary to what Peter would be anticipating. The Son of Man must suffer. Why would that be contrary to what Peter was looking for in the Christ or the Messiah?
They thought he was going to be exalted and probably have a
No, you're right. So they had this picture in their mind, right? They had a completely different picture. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Yep. No, you're absolutely right. And again, those are all correct. What we're looking at here is that Peter had this picture in his mind about what was supposed to be. He had this overall idea of how, when the Messiah came, what his life would be like, what the Messiah's life would be like, and we're going to see here that it's really the exact opposite of what it is that he was looking for. But let's go further on down in our list here. It says that the Son of Man must suffer many things. And number two, it says that he must be rejected by the elders. So, in what ways was he rejected by the elders? Okay. Well, crucifixion? Yeah, ultimately, yes. No, you're right. And who were the Jewish leadership supposed to be when the Messiah came? They were supposed to be God's chosen people, right? They were supposed to be the ones welcoming him in. And when you look in the Gospels, you'll see that when they thought Jesus was who, you know, when they thought he was the one who was going to fulfill their picture of who the Messiah should be, they did welcome him in, right? They did do that. But it says here that the Son of Man must be rejected by them. Again, why is that contrary to what Peter's image would have been or what his mindset would have been? It's because he was supposed to be one who was welcomed in, right? He was supposed to be one who was brought in, and we all know the story or the account of the triumphant entry, right? We see here that it says that he must be rejected by the elders and the chief priests. So basically all of the Jewish leadership and the scribes. And then the fourth and final thing that he must, or actually no, the third thing, I'm sorry, that he must do, it says, and he must be killed. Now, why is that contrary to what Peter had in mind? You know, how is someone who's dead going to restore us back into power? How is that going to happen? Can that happen? And as you can see, I just want you guys to get this picture in your mind as Jesus is telling Peter these things. Because you can almost see his face when you're reading this passage. And you're going to see the way he reacts to what Jesus has to tell him. But you can see that his blood is probably starting to boil, right? He's probably starting to get an emotional rush of some sort, whether it's anger or disappointment, probably all of them. Just a lot of different emotions. But what is it that is important? We see that the Son of Man must fulfill these things, and that's his role. And the fourth thing that it says that he must fulfill is that he must rise again after 3 days. How is it that the Son of Man is going to rise if he doesn't die first? And when we look at the resurrection and how vital that is to our faith, how vital that is to our being as Christians. You know, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, if someone would turn there real quick, keep your finger in Mark chapter 8. And turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And someone read for us verses 12 through 14 for us. Yes, sir. Your preaching is empty, and your faith is also empty. So you can see how important, just in those couple of verses, how significant the resurrection is to each and every single one of us. Paul says, if Christ is not raised from the dead, if that didn't happen, then there's nothing for us to look forward to. Right? Paul in Philippians chapter 2 said that's what his hope was in, the power of the resurrection. The fact that we can one day be raised from the dead. So when we're looking at what the Christ's purpose is, why it is that he came to this earth, it was so that he could suffer, so that he could be rejected, so that he could die and be raised again. That's what the Christ was put here to do. That's why God sent him. That's what he had to fulfill while he was here on earth. And it's important for us to understand that before we begin to look at what it means to be a disciple. Because when we look at what it meant for Christ to be the king on this earth, it's a completely different picture than what they were anticipating, what they were looking at. Yes, sir.
Now, this is such a good example of us not getting confused, our expectations, not only the expectations, but our timing on things, too. You know, they had this expectation of what a king would be. It's not what and they had an expectation of time. Those were a couple of dark days there from the time Jesus had died until he rose, because they thought all of those things that he had preached, they're done.
Yeah.
Until he rose. And it reinforces to me the difference between my expectations and my timing of when I want things to happen with God.
Yep. No, you're right. There's, again, that's a very good comment, but you know, when we're looking at what Christ is teaching them here, you know, if you think that they're misunderstanding what the Christ and who the Christ is supposed to be, you think that they're misunderstanding what discipleship is. If they don't understand what it means to be the king in the kingdom, do you think that they understand of how it is that they're supposed to be disciples? And we're going to see that here in a second. But that's why Christ, he needs them to understand this before he leaves, before he departs. He needs them to understand what it meant for him to be the Christ in order for them to be able to fulfill their role as the subjects in the kingdom, the disciples in the kingdom. So that's what we're going to be looking at here. It says here in chapter 8, verse 32, it says, "And he said this plainly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, 'Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on things of God, but on things of man.'" Peter, how was it that Peter was setting his mind on things of man rather than things of God? Yes, ma'am. So, and he's a heavenly king, right? So, if that means that that they're wrong, that whatever it is that they have in their minds is contrary to what Christ has in mind or what God has in mind, does that mean that they're going to have to change what it is that they have in view for their life? Does that mean that they're going to have to completely go turn 100% around? What is it that Jesus had them do when he first called them out as disciples, the first few disciples? He had them leave their livelihood, right? He had them leave behind everything. And of course, that's not something that we have to do today. We don't all have to pick up and leave our jobs. But it's that same concept. And we're going to be looking a lot at that a lot here in these next few verses. But he says, "Get behind me, Satan." You think it was important about what Christ has to say and them understanding these concepts? He referred to Peter as Satan. That's pretty serious. Yep.
And that's a problem, first and foremost, to a lot of people not wanting to be in subjection to anything.
Mm-hmm.
Even the people at this time, even though they were in subjection, "Oh, here's somebody else we've got to be in subjection to." You know, it just seems like everywhere we turn, we're under subjection. And a lot of people, even today, have trouble with that, to give up themselves in order to.
No, you're absolutely right, and we're going to look at that more. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Yep.
And he began it with that.
And if we continue to go down that path, if they were to continue to have the same kind of mindset, they would be working not for God or the things of God, but they'd be working for Satan, right? Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And let's continue on in these next few verses, and we're actually going to refer back to something that you just said. But it says here in verse 34, It says, in calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone would come after me. Now, so he's going to begin to correct them on what it is that that they should be his disciples. He's now established what it means for him to be the Messiah, the Christ. It means that he's going to have to suffer, he's going to have to be rejected, and he's going to have to be killed, and he's going to have to be rise again after 3 days. That's what it means for him to be the Christ, the Messiah, the King. So this is what you have to do as a disciple. It says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself. Okay? So deny yourself in what way? If you would turn to Mark chapter 10. And if someone would read verse 35 and 36. Actually, I'm sorry. Read verse 35. Let's go through verse 37. In Mark chapter 10, if someone would read that for us.
Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him, saying, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. And he said to them, What do you want me to do for you? They said to him, Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left. In your glory.
Okay, wait a second. All right, we just read, okay, deny yourself. This is what Jesus told them. What is the very first question that they ask Jesus? Or what is their very first request, if you will? Jesus, we want you to do what we want you to do. Or do for us whatever we want. Right? That's completely backwards. That's completely, and you see that even in Mark chapter 10, that they're still not getting it. This is completely after, or entirely after they have this whole conversation. And again, what we're going to go through here in these next few verses. But this is completely contrary to what Christ wanted. He says, deny yourself. What does it mean to deny yourself? You know, when we think about what we want, and the things that we want, you know, when we consider that in the scope of us being Christians, you know, when I can remember first becoming a Christian and getting the swing of things, you know, starting to attend worship and things like that, you know, if you've been in the world for any amount of time, you know that Saturdays are pretty much your day to get everything done, right? Saturdays are your day to go shopping. Saturdays are your day to get errands done, and you spend this whole day just doing all the things that you can't do during the work week, right? And Sundays are your days to sleep in, right? That's the day that you go and sleep in. That was my day to sleep in, anyways. What does that mean for us as Christians? Am I still now going to get what I want? Am I still going to use that day, the first day of the week, to sleep in? You know, because us as Christians, we still have to work Saturdays, right? We still have a lot of things we need to do on Saturdays. I'd still like to sleep in on Sundays. It says, deny yourself. This is what needs to be done if you're my disciple. And again, what I want us to see here, and what the text is really trying to tell us, is that Peter had this idea in mind of what it meant for him to be a subject. And we see that in Mark chapter 10, what we just read. We see that in Mark chapter 10, he says that we want to be at your right hand and at your left. We want to be in power, right? That's what I want. That's what I have decided, and that's what I have planned for my life. But what is it that Jesus wants? What is it that God wants? It says, deny yourself. Yes, ma'am. Well, you know, that's a possibility. That's definitely a possibility. But we see, even in the latter chapters of this gospel, we still see that they don't understand what it means for them to be disciples, or what it means for them to have a kingdom here on earth. They're still not getting it. Either way, they're still not understanding what it means. Because that's not the question that they should be asking. Christ, I want you to do for me whatever I want you to do. What question is it that they should be asking? What is it that I can do for you? You're the king, right? You're the king and I'm the subject. What is it that I can do for you? That's what the question that they should be asking. Yep.
You know, you talk about the things Jesus had to suffer. I think that emotional aspect would have been very hard. His teaching and them not getting it. The crowds seeing his power and they don't get it. Seeing him heal people, raise lives, and still not get it. I think the emotional suffering was tough on him.
Oh, yeah.
Wondering, granted, he knew everything being God, but to think, these are the people I'm going to leave it to,
Yeah.
That emotional stress would have been something to suffer.
Jesus was definitely on a timetable. He definitely had a lot to accomplish prior to his death. But what does this mean for us? What does it mean for us to deny ourselves? Well, that means that even though I don't want to, I'm going to get up every Sunday morning and I'm going to go meet with the Lord's people. That means that even though it's uncomfortable, I'm going to go proclaim the gospel to people around me. That means even though it may cause me suffering, I'm still going to remain a Christian in times of persecution. You know, we have this idea in our minds about what it's going to be like to be a Christian, just like they had an idea in their minds of what it was going to be like to be a subject in the kingdom when the Messiah comes. We think, you know, again, if you can refer back to the time when you became a Christian, that it was all going to be peaches and cream, right? It was going to be easy peasy. God was going to solve all of my problems, and that was going to be it. You know, there's not going to be any problems in the Lord's church because, you know, Christians always act like Christians, right? No. You know, so there's going to be difficult times. And there's going to be times of suffering. There's going to be times that we're going to have to endure. And maybe we didn't understand that. Maybe we did. Maybe we did understand that our life was going to have to change when we decided to become Christians. But what does it mean for me to be a disciple? It means that I'm going to have to deny whatever it is that I had in mind prior to becoming a Christian. Whether it is that I'm going to deny myself, and again, I know I've referred back to this, but I can remember first becoming a Christian, and at the time I was very busy. I was extremely busy. I was going to school to be a sports doctor. I was playing tennis. I was doing all sorts of things prior to becoming a Christian. And I realized once I did become a Christian that I had absolutely no time for God. There's no time in my schedule that I had for God. I was busy from the time I woke up in the morning to the time that I went to sleep. And there was very little sleep in between there. And I had this vision in my mind of what my life was going to be like. That I was going to have all this money and that I was going to be adventurous and I was going to travel the world and do all these things. And I still may be able to do some of those things. But that was what I was setting out to do. When I became a disciple, I had to deny myself certain things. And no, not everyone has to make the same decisions I make. Not everyone's going to be a preacher, obviously. But what is it that I have in mind? Even right now as a Christian, what is my goal? What is it that I'm setting out to do as a disciple of Christ? Yes, ma'am. No. And that's the very next thing that he says. You're absolutely right. Yeah, what, if you notice those statements, it's what I want, right? It's I, everything. But it says to deny yourself, take up your cross. Okay, there's been some confusion about what it means to take up your cross. You know, every once in a while you hear someone say, oh, well, my back hurts, and that's just my cross to bear, right? Or some sort of physical illness. And in some ways, we've sanitized the cross. What was the cross in the first century? It was an implement of death, right? And that's what the first thing they or would have popped into their minds when they heard, take up your cross. You know, when we think take up our cross, we think of a necklace or some form of jewelry or something like that, or a statue that you see. What does it mean to take up your cross? Not only do we need to deny ourselves, but whatever it is that we're denying that doesn't fit our discipleship, that needs to be nailed to the cross. It needs to be put to death, right? And you see this imagery throughout the New Testament in very common scriptures, like in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. You know, I've been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. The life I now live in the flesh is, you know, we've all heard those passages that talk about crucifying yourself with Christ, right? So, what does that mean for us as disciples? If we're going to really become disciples, we're going to have to first deny ourselves, take up our cross, and then the last thing it says is follow me. And that's the hard part, right? That's the very difficult part. Because a lot of times we'll make the decision to become a Christian. We'll deny ourselves. Then we'll go along and live our lives, and we begin to, we say that we've taken up our cross, but then we forget to continue in that direction, to follow Christ in His footsteps. It says to follow me. And I'm sorry, we're running out of time, but I'd like to get in these next few verses here, if we can, here in Mark chapter 8. It says, for whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. There in Mark chapter 8 and verse 35. Whoever loses his life will save it. So what does that mean? Does that make any sense? Well, what life is he talking about losing? He's talking about your earthly life, right? If you are someone who is going to strive after saving your earthly life, whatever it is that you had in mind, your self-control, if you're going to be focused on saving that life, then what is it ultimately that's going to happen? You're going to lose it, right? You're going to lose the life that truly matters. But he says whoever loses his life for the sake of the gospels and for his sake will save it. What is it that's required for us to do as disciples? And again, our mindset isn't far off from what the Jewish mindset of the time would be. You know, go and get yours while you're here on earth. Go and get everything that you can. Make as much money and do everything that you possibly can in this earth to satisfy whatever lifestyle you have in mind. That was a similar mindset that the Jewish people had when the Messiah would come. But Jesus said, the Son of Man's going to have to suffer. The Son of Man is going to be rejected. The Son of Man's going to have to be killed, and He's going to be raised again, just like we will one day. But when we look at what Jesus' mindset was, you know, it's a very powerful passage in the garden when He's praying. What is it that He said when He's praying in the garden before He's betrayed or before He's arrested? He says, let this cup pass from me, right? Let this cup, Lord, if there's any other way that you can accomplish your task, do it. Jesus didn't want to go to the cross. He knew that He was going to have to go through suffering. And deep down, He knew that that's the only way that God could accomplish His purpose. But Jesus didn't want to go to the cross. But what is it that He says? He says, not my will, but yours, right? And Jesus followed it. And then the next few verses we see here, it says, "For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of God or his Father with the holy angels." And now I know we have to wrap it up here really quick, but I want us to leave with this illustration or example, if you will. You know, a lot of times you'll get the question asked, what would you forfeit your soul for? $1 million? $1 billion? And, you know, we recognize that there's a lot of people who sell out for a lot less than that. But what is it that you would forfeit for your soul? And when we think about it, realistically, no one's ever going to offer us that obligation or offer us that ultimatum. You know, if I gave you $1 million, would you stop being a Christian? No one's going to offer you $1 million in your life. But what is it that each and every single one of us is offered on a daily basis? We're offered control over our own lives, right? We're offered the choice to either make the right decisions or the wrong decisions. Each and every single one of us is offered to have control and to do whatever it is that you want to do in this life. If you wanted to go out and try to make lots of money, you could go and do that. If you wanted to go out and do whatever the world thinks is important, you could go and do those things. And we all have, especially in the United States, we have the opportunity to go and do those things. We're all offered that. But what is it that we have to do as disciples? It says that we must first deny ourselves, take up our cross, and follow Jesus. You know, when we think about the scope of eternity and what that means, when we think about eternity and what Jesus is really asking us for, he's only asking us for a little bit. And I know we've got to stop now. We've got to close it up. But I just want us to understand what it means to be a disciple in Christ's kingdom. Christ didn't come to live this luxurious lifestyle when he came to earth. Christ didn't come to seek out those things, even though he could have provided himself those things, right? We sing the song, he could have called 10,000 angels. We sing different songs about what Christ could have done, but he didn't, because he knew that's what the will of the Father was. And again, when we looked at the young rich man, the will of the Father for him was that he needed to get rid of all of his riches, because that was the one thing that was standing between him and God. But what is it that he had his mind on? He didn't have his mind set on the things of God, he had his mind set on the things of man, which is whatever it is that he had in mind. So when we go out and we act as disciples of Christ and we live out being a disciple or a subject in Christ's kingdom, whose kingdom do I want to be a part of when the Lord returns? Do I want to be a part of my kingdom, the one that I've established, or do I want to be a part of Christ's eternal kingdom? Because that's ultimately the choice, right? When we're establishing ourselves here on earth, we're developing and building up ourselves a kingdom that's not going to survive. But Christ says, if you're not ashamed of me, you're going to do as I instructed you to do. Thank you guys so much for your attention. I apologize for going a little bit over.